It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. In another 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court yesterday ruled that public sector employee unions cannot mandate dues as part of their collective bargaining, but they must include all employees in their collective bargaining. That essentially strips public employee unions of their power and makes the United States a right-to-work nation. What do you think of this decision? Was this foretold by Wisconsin's Act 10? Will this be an end to unions as we know them? Give us a call this morning, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are going to be talking to Joseph Slater from Toledo, University of Toledo College of Law. We're still trying to get him on the line. But the issues that come up with this is that Anthony Kennedy voted in the majority in Janus, and Anthony Kennedy has also announced his retirement. And that we're going to be talking about in the next hour. Joseph Slater is with us now. He's the Eugene N. Bock Professor of Law and Values at the University of Toledo College of Law. He specializes in labor and public sector employment law. Joe, thank you for being with us to figure this out.
Thanks for having me.
So just a few hours after the Janus decision, we need to talk about this Kennedy thing. Anthony Kennedy announced that he was retiring. He has often played the role of swing voter on this divided court. You are a Supreme Court watcher in general and a labor lawyer in particular. What is your reaction to Kennedy's leaving?
Well, I think it will make the court more conservative. Justice Kennedy has been, as you say, a swing voter on some issues. For example, the Janus case and other issues involving workers, he has voted fairly reliably with the conservatives. But in cases such as those involving the rights of gays and lesbians and transgender folks and the rights to choice in the abortion realm, he has been at least a moderate and has provided a swing vote for example, the gay marriage decision. So I think in some ways his departure will make a big difference in some issues, not such a big difference in other issues. But of course, the other factor here is that assuming President Trump appoints someone that we expect him, as we expect him to appoint, that it'll be a younger person, so this will have a lasting impact on the court.
A younger person and much, much farther to the right than Kennedy, right?
I mean, presumably, yes. Again, Kennedy was to the right on some issues and more moderate on other issues. So I think again, it would not have made any difference for the decision in Janus. It would not have made any difference right in the decision in Epic Systems and other areas involving workers' rights. But it could very much in the area of abortion rights and gay and lesbian rights.
So you noted that that Kennedy voted with a majority in Janus. This didn't surprise you, did it?
No. His questioning at oral argument was very hostile toward the unions.
Interesting. So let's talk about Janus. Let's talk about the specifics. The complainant, Mark Janus, filed a suit against his union, which was AFSCME, correct?
Yes.
So what did Mark Janus do, and why did he file a suit against his union?
Well, Mark Janus lives in a state, Illinois, like just under half the states, which permit what are called union security clauses. Union security clauses are provisions in collective bargaining agreements between employers and unions that say, as a condition of employment, if you are a member of a union bargaining unit, you must pay the union the costs that the union incurs for representing you. You must pay at least that portion of your dues that go to matters that the union does that are, and this is the legal term, related to collective bargaining.
Collective bargaining is when unions negotiate with employers about things like salaries and safety and benefits and things like that, right?
Right. It's the whole contract formation process, and it also includes this term related to collective bargaining. It also includes enforcing the contract, so grievances and arbitrations. So under a 41-year-old Supreme Court precedent called Abood, it was decided in 1977, The way the law has worked since then is in states that permit union security clauses, a union security clause can charge members of union bargaining units for those costs that are related to collective bargaining. They cannot, however, legally charge objectors, people who make a formal objection, for activities not related to collective bargaining. Mm. And the biggest example of that is politics. So to give an example, if a public sector union spends 85% of its money on contract negotiation issues and grievance and arbitration issues, but 15% of its money on politics, then someone in Mark Janus's position that didn't want to pay any dues for the union's political activities could legally object and say, I'm not going to pay that 15%. But he would still have to pay the other 85%.
So wait a second, let me get this straight. Since 1977, union members have not been having their dues go to politics?
Since 1977, members of union bargaining units had the right to opt out of paying for those activities that go to politics.
Interesting. So do you find that people actually don't know that? Because that was surprising to me.
Some people know that, some people don't. So the National Right to Work Foundation, for example, has made it their mission to inform people of that right. But I think and unions are required to, the rules that developed under Abood, unions are required to tell employees that when they are initially hired and when at least once a year. So they should know.
So, okay, so talking about this 1977 Abood case, it ruled that unions could use the fees to only cover collective bargaining. So Mark Janus's money wasn't going or didn't have to go to political speech, to political purposes, just to collective bargaining. So what was he arguing for?
Well, he was arguing, and this is in fact one of the arguments that the Supreme Court accepted, that literally everything a public sector union does is inherently political to the point where it deserves First Amendment protection. So the compromise that was reached under Abood was, well, you know, some things are politics, like the union gives money to a candidate or has a phone bank or does other activities that support political candidates, but some things public sector unions do are not political, like collective bargaining. Janus's argument, and again the argument that the court accepted, was that, hey, everything a union does is political because, for example, say they bargain for a wage increase that affects the public budget, so that's inherently political. And apparently even things like representing workers in grievances and arbitration, you know, Jane is late an hour, she gets disciplined, the union wants to challenge the discipline. Apparently, under the Janus ruling, that is now also political. That was his argument. That's what the Supreme Court accepted.
Interesting. So are they arguing that just coming together and representing, you know, being a group of people rather than individuals dealing with an employer, that is somehow political?
Well, that's a great question, and it gets into one of the more difficult parts of the case and one of, I think, the least persuasive parts of the majority decision, because there has already been a lot of litigation on the First Amendment rights of individual public employees, people who are not in unions, just a secretary in a public institution who says that she's in favor of this candidate or that candidate or makes a statement about public matters. What the Supreme Court has consistently held in a series of cases called Connick and Pickering and Garcetti and some others is that for individual public employees, discussing everyday matters about the workplace, your wages, your hours, and working conditions are not political, are not a matter of public concern, and therefore don't get First Amendment protection. So the needle that the majority had to thread in order to rule the way it did is to somehow say, but when individual employees talk about their wages, hours, and working conditions, that's not a matter of public concern, and therefore that does not get First Amendment protection. But when unions do it, it somehow is. what the majority says about that is, well, unions are, as you said, coming together and acting collectively and therefore have more of an impact. But I think Justice Kagan made a good reply to that in her dissent when she said,
okay, well, we're going to get into Justice Kagan's dissent when we come back. We're talking to Joe Slater about the Supreme Court's decision on unions yesterday. We'll talk about the dissenting opinions. It was another 5-4 vote. When we come back, it's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Joe Slater is a labor law professor at the University of Toledo. He specializes in the Supreme Court, and he's a pretty busy guy these days. Today, we're talking to Joe about yesterday's decision to strike down a mandate for union members working for governments to have to pay union dues. What do you think about this decision? Were you aware that union dues have not gone to political causes or did not have to go to political causes since 1977? 800-642-1234 is the number here. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have a number of calls we are going to get to. But first, Joe, I want to follow up on what we were talking about before the break. We were talking about the idea that maybe this decision has actually said people in groups do not have First Amendment rights, but individuals do have First Amendment rights. And you were talking about Justice Kagan's response. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's a little bit more the other way around. So individuals under Supreme Court precedent, Connick, Pickering, and Garcetti, don't have First Amendment rights when they are talking about workplace issues. The First Amendment doesn't cover public employees as a matter of law when they're talking about normal workplace grievances, say these cases. However, what Jana says is that unions talking about workplace grievances does implicate the First Amendment. That was, as I was saying before the break, a tricky needle for the majority to thread. I'm not sure Justice Alito did it successfully intellectually. What he says is, well, unions are more powerful than individuals, so when Jane asks for a 5% raise, that's different in terms of public impact and public importance than when a union it does. Justice Kagan, in her dissent, one of the better points I think she makes is that that's a pretty unclear rule, and she gives hypos of 2, 3, 4 or more employees complaining about their workplace conditions. You know, should that be covered by the First Amendment or not? It's currently unclear. I'm not sure the majority satisfactorily answers that, but of course that's a law professor's opinion, and further cases will have to clarify who exactly gets First Amendment protection when they talk about workplace conditions now.
Is it fair to say that unions' First Amendment protections have been weakened by Janus?
Well, you could say, advocates for the majority would say, that the First Amendment rights of members of union bargaining units have been strengthened. That will have the effect of weakening unions, because in states that are not currently what's called right-to-work states, states like my state of Ohio, where these union security clauses were legal, unions will now no longer be able to charge anybody any money for the costs of representing them, which, and I think this is a very important point, in all public sector labor laws and in all labor laws in general, there is a rule called the duty of fair representation, which requires unions to represent members, to spend money on members, both in contract negotiations and in grievance and arbitration handling, regardless of whether they pay dues. So now people will be able to avoid paying dues and still get all the benefits of union membership, and that will hurt unions.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. We are taking your calls here on Janus, 800-642-1234. Joe from Waukesha, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I think this issue in a major way goes back to Reagan in, I think it was around 1980, the air traffic controller. Mm-hmm. And Reagan's reaction, of course, was to fire them all. Now, if we had a healthy, society, sadly, I think divide and conquer reigned then and now. In other words, what could have and should have happened at the time is that everyone, going from pilots to, baggage handlers to everyone in the industry, they should have shut down the entire system. Reagan would have had egg all over his face, and it would have sent a clear message, that this is not going to work. But instead, what happened, of course, was the air traffic controllers just hung out to dry. And it was a definite signal, I think, to corporate America that unions are really paper tigers and we can do what we want. The other members of the company or the, other workers are not going to band together to protect one another. And therefore, essentially, it's been going on ever since then. The right to work is another example in this state and so forth. So I really think, unfortunately, this recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court is just one more nail in the coffin of unions. We now have probably about the lowest union membership in the developed world, and it's not surprising because it's been going on, as I said, for at least 40 years.
So, Joe brings up a good point. I'm talking to two Joes here. That this started with the air traffic controller strike. I remember that strike, and I remember people saying this is the first step in the death of unions. Joe Slater, do you agree with that?
I think there's a lot of force to that argument, and without making even more confusion by referring to another person with the same name, there's a great book, which your caller may be familiar, on the PATCO strike and its impact on the labor movement in American politics by a guy named Joseph McCartan from Georgetown called Collision Course. And if anybody's interested in the PATCO strike, I would recommend that book, Joe McCartan, Collision Course. There has been a general decline in the labor movement that's been going on for decades. It's likely Janus will contribute to that. I would only say, I agree with pretty much everything your caller says. We do have one of the lowest rates of unionization in at least the Western world, certainly in the private sector. The rates of unionization in the public sector, however, have been pretty robust, and I think one of the reasons you've seen attacks specifically on public sector unions going back, say, to Act 10 in Wisconsin in 2011 through the Janus decision is because that's where a substantial portion of the American labor movement is today. One of the reasons Janus will have such a major impact is nearly half of all union members in America today are in the public sector. So the public sector has been doing, relatively speaking, relatively well, but it's been under attack in the last decade.
We are talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision of Janus, which essentially strips labor unions of their right to collective bargain or to actually charge fees to collective bargaining from their members. And one of the things that has struck me about this, Joe Slater, is that this was brought by a union member who, it seems to me, would be not acting in his best interest to sue his own union. So talk to me about why he brought this suit.
Well, yes, formally, but there's a little more to it. This particular suit, was originally started. The original person who wanted to be the plaintiff was the Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner. And court said, you don't have standing to bring this suit because you're not a union member. You're not paying union dues of any kind to a union. So they found a bargaining unit member to be the plaintiff. But I think it's important to understand that a lot of these suits are brought by anti-union organizations and Republican politicians, and that's what's backing them. But Mark Janus is a real union member, and like some union members, he doesn't like his union, and he doesn't like what they're doing, and he doesn't want to pay for anything. And I think what you see in unions these days is that unions can only come in when they are supported by a majority, like any political election. But like any political election, there are people who don't want to, did not support the union. And in terms of specifically paying dues, there's a third type of person. There's a type of person who doesn't mind the union benefits, but doesn't like to pay dues because, hey, as I mentioned before,
get it for free.
Doctrine, right, you can get this all for free. As I often say, I like the company that gives me Wi-Fi just fine. I mean, my service is good, the price is reasonable. But if they were legally obligated to give me Wi-Fi for free, I might not pay.
Mm-hmm.
There's significant evidence that some of the people who aren't paying union dues are people who like the benefits but just don't want to pay for them. And there's no evidence that Mark Janus is refusing to take his pay increases or refusing any of the other protections his union contract gets him. But he is part of an ideological movement that wants to weaken unions.
Well, we will get to that in a moment. I want to take a phone call here. Steve from Sun Prairie, you wanted to talk about something that Justice Kagan said, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm torn on the whole issue. I'm a big believer in a free association, which also means you don't have to associate. But one of the things that Justin Kagan said, which I, you know, found a little bit disturbing, and I'll probably butcher it a little bit, but words of the fact that the First Amendment is designed for things more important than this or better than this. And that's just a frightening statement to me. And I guess wanted to know what your guest's opinion of a justice deciding what free speech she thinks is important.
So Kagan also said that the court is weaponizing the First Amendment, Joe. I don't know if we were talking about the same thing here.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the quote was from that your caller is referring to, but let me take it in two points. First of all, about freedom of association. So the model that we have in the U.S. for unions is what's called majority exclusive representation, which again means that if you have, for example, 60 widget makers and 40 of them want to be in a union, then all 60 of them are going to be in a union, mm-hmm. whereas if 20 of them want to be in a union, none of them are going to be in a union. It's modeled on political democracy, right? I vote for a mayor. Some people vote for my guy. Some people vote for the other guy. But the mayor is the mayor of the town, even though there's people who voted against him. Now, you can have alternative models. And, for example, in Europe, there are what are called members-only unions. So if there's 60 widget makers and only 20 of them want to be in a union, only 20 of them are in a union. And only if 40 of them want to be in a union, only 40 of them are in a union. That's never been the model in the U.S., rightly or wrongly. So we have this exclusive majority model, and the vision of union dues has sort of been like taxes, right? If the majority supports a certain mayor, governor, president, I pay my taxes, even if I didn't vote for that guy, you know, and the taxes go for things I don't necessarily support, that's life. Again, different model in Europe, but I think that's unlikely to happen here. Second, as to the quote from Justice Kagan, I'm not sure exactly what part of her dissent your caller is referring to, but I think her point was that, and this goes back to a point I was making earlier, again, traditionally under Supreme Court precedent, the free speech rights of public employees in the workplace have been limited. And they have been limited by, among other things, all of those conservative justices who voted in favor of Janus and the majority. So I think Kagan's point was, gee, we have traditionally said that public employers have a right to manage their workforce. So you can't have public employees just saying any stupid, crazy thing that they want in the workplace, whereas maybe if it was in a public park, they could say any crazy, stupid thing that they mm-hmm. want. But, you know, in the workplace, First Amendment rights are limited. So I think what Kagan was pointing to is that there's a tradition of, specifically in the context of public workers talking about their workplace, that there have been limits put on that because of the legitimate interests of public employers to manage their workforces. Here in Illinois, the state of Illinois took the position that union security clauses were important to help them manage their workforce because having robust unions help them manage their workforce, but the court rejected that. And I think Justice Kagan was pointing out that inconsistency.
Interesting. So we are taking your calls on Janus. Today, Janus is, of course, the ruling that the Supreme Court made yesterday that quite literally weakens public sector unions because people will not have to pay dues to belong to their union. That is going to lead to probably people not paying dues and unions having less money. Joseph Slater is a labor specialist at the University of Toledo College of Law, and he's talking us through this. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, to give us your opinion on Janus. If unions are the losers in this case, Joe, who are the winners and who has the most to gain from this decision?
I think the biggest winner in this decision is probably going to be the Republican Party. I think, again, that these suits have been motivated by both Republicans and to some extent business interests that want to see unions weakened in general. One of the things that's interesting to me in these types of suits is that public employers themselves have not particularly lined up on the side of Janus. Public employers often like the unions and have good working relationships with unions. But there was an article yesterday that showed that when states have gone right to work, that lowers the percentage of people voting for Democrats by about 3%. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you and some of your listeners recall in the debates over Act 10 in Wisconsin back in 2011, there were Republican state representatives who were saying things like, well, this will, you know, ensure that President Obama won't carry Wisconsin in 2012. Obviously, he did in 2012, but again, the Republican candidate won Wisconsin in 2016. So I think this is largely partisan politics and part of an effort by big business to weaken labor unions. And I think it will, at the margins, have that effect.
And will it have that effect for, what, 10 years, 20 years? How far do you see this ruling putting its tentacles into the U.S. System?
Well, I mean, I think at least for a decade. I mean, like all Supreme Court decisions, this decision could be reversed. And there are other things going on in politics and with the labor movement in general. But, you know, the current prognosis for the Supreme Court, obviously, is that it will be conservative for a while. As we were talking at the very beginning of the show, the replacement of Justice Kennedy, likely by a younger and more conservative person, will continue that. So, yeah, this will have an impact, a significant impact on American politics, I think, not just the workplace, but American politics for probably decades.
We're talking to Joe Slater about the Supreme Court's decision on unions yesterday. We'll see if Wisconsin's Act 10 can help us understand how the rest of the country might react to this ruling. We are taking your calls today, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The Supreme Court's decision on unions yesterday will be Anthony Kennedy's last, or one of his last. Will it spell an end to labor unions? What will that say about the fate of the Democratic Party, especially in light of the Supreme Court's decision on gerrymandering, or actually not to decide gerrymandering? We're talking to Joe Slater about the Supreme Court's decision on unions yesterday. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. And ideas at WPR.org is our email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joe, I do want to talk about that gerrymandering decision really quickly. I know this isn't your expertise, but does Kennedy leaving actually make this decision go the way of gerrymandering is okay and states can redistrict any way they want?
I think within some limits that is the likely scenario. Again, if we assume that President Trump will appoint the type of nominee that we think that he will appoint, which is someone younger and more right-wing than Justice Kennedy, it would be predictable that that new justice would be less willing to overturn even fairly egregious examples of gerrymandering.
We will. You know what? We're going to get into that in the next hour when we're talking specifically about Kennedy. I want to talk about Act 10 here in Wisconsin. How has that played out? That was essentially also a stripping of benefits for public employee unions. How has that played out, and how is that a harbinger for how Janus is going to play out in the rest of the country?
Well, the first thing to be clear on is that Act 10 did much more radical things in Wisconsin than Janus is going to do, because while all Janus does is make union security clauses illegal. Beyond that, unions in, for example, my state of Ohio still have robust collective bargaining rights, can bargain about wages, hours, working conditions. Unions in my state of Ohio can even, public sector unions can even go on strike. So I don't want to underplay the significance of Janus, because I think that unions will take a real hit financially. But I don't think it will literally be the end of unions and union organizing. What happened in Act 10 in Wisconsin was more radical. Not only did you have an elimination of union security clauses, making them illegal, not only did you have eliminations of not just the limited strike rights that public sector workers in Wisconsin had previously, but also other ways of resolving bargaining impasses, but it literally limited what unions could bargain about to only base wages, and even base wages only up to the cost of living. So unions in Wisconsin, public sector unions in Wisconsin, since Act 10, could negotiate about almost literally nothing. Mm. And there were some other oppressive rules, having to undergo mandatory recertification elections literally every year, where in order to stay being a union, you had to win a majority, not just of those voting in this mandatory recertification election, but a majority, actually a supermajority, 51% of all of the people in the bargaining unit, including those who didn't vote. So Act 10 was much more aggressive. Now, of course, Act 10 was only limited to Wisconsin.
Right.
Janus is nationwide. So Act 10 had a very, very negative impact on unions in Wisconsin, a major loss of membership and a major loss of union presence in the state. I would not anticipate Janus to have that sort of impact nationwide. For example, I don't think Janus is going to cause anything like that in Ohio, New York, California, even Illinois, the state that it came from. I would say, in terms of the impact that Act 10 had, as you and your at least some of your listeners probably know, there were other laws in 2011 limiting the rights of public sector workers in some other states, none nearly as radical as Act 10, but still some that hurt public sector unions. And recently, the only major move in this direction was that Iowa last year adopted a law that was largely similar to Act 10. On the other hand, you have the examples of the fairly successful teachers' strikes in West Virginia, Colorado, and some other states. So maybe there is a glimmer of hope in that type of organizing for unions.
We are talking about the Janus ruling yesterday from the Supreme Court. We are taking your calls. Don from Jackson, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I think your call, your guest is missing a couple points. One is that unionism is protectionism. People that aren't willing to give a a full day's work for a full day's pay. They're being protected by the union, and a lot of fellow union workers see that. Secondly, you know, they talk about possibly unionizing the fast food workers. Well, you know, for example, McDonald's, I don't care how long you've been flipping hamburgers, how good you are flipping hamburgers, that job is only worth a certain value. The union wants to come in and pay everybody $15, $20 an hour, whatever it is, and it's just an unworkable financial model. And thirdly, basically Act 10, best thing ever happened in Wisconsin. That's okay. All I have. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John. I love when people call in and tell us our experts don't know what they're talking about. So, Joe, McDonald's employees unionizing, is this something that's going to hurt? Joe?
Well, let me get back to the first point. I mean, I am not an expert on whether unionization is a good idea or not. What I can say is that what the Janus decision does, what it applies to, is workplaces where a majority of workers have decided that they want a union. Uh-huh. And then the question is, what is the consequence in that workplace when the union then has to incur expenses to pay for contract negotiation and grievance and arbitration handling for the workers that have chosen them? And it's difficult when, even after a majority has chosen a union, the union doesn't get income. There is considerable evidence in Iowa and other states that people will vote for a union. A majority of employees will vote for a union. And if the rule is right to work, if the rule is that you can't have union security clauses, as Janus now mandates, in jurisdictions where that's the rule, you have multiple examples, and this was in the Janus brief, of employees voting for a union, a majority, and then only a minority deciding to pay dues.
Okay, so wait a second, though. Doesn't this then, the way you're explaining it here, doesn't this then go against the idea of majority rule in the U.S.?
Well, that would be the other side of the argument to the one that your caller presented, because what I'm stressing is people can have different opinions about whether unions are good, bad, indifferent, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but in a situation where a majority of the affected workers have chosen to have a union, and that union is obligated to represent those workers, it creates a problem when people say, sure, I want a union, and I want all the benefits of the union, but I don't want to pay for it. And that's the problem that unions are going to be facing after Janus.
We are talking about Janus in the next few minutes here. Sandy from Mineral Point, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show. The big losers in this, ultimately, as unions are chipped away at, are going to be the employees. Because eventually they won't have the collective bargaining, they won't have the ability to have safety issues taken care of, they won't have the ability, to get their insurance and all that at a lower price because they bargained that. Right. And so the employees will be the big losers.
Thank you, Sandy, for that. Employees will be the big users. I'm going to change the conversation a little bit, Joe. Can unions restructure? Can unions become maybe a political unit that is outside of a specific employer, and anybody can join a union that has a sort of a different mission?
Well, I think what we have seen over the last couple of decades in the private sector as well as the public sector is a proliferation of organizations which are, as exactly as you say, outside the union movement. They're typically called generically workers' centers, where they are organizations of groups who are not necessarily employers of any one employer, but rather stand for workers' rights. These worker centers have done some great work. The limiting factor, however, is where are they going to get their funding, right? Because what union security clauses have done is provided unions a reliable source of funding, and groups that sort of depend on donations from individuals that don't have to donate and don't have any connection with an individual workplace are typically going to be financially somewhat a little bit unstable and a little bit at risk. And to get back to your caller's point, I did want to add, yes, I do believe that employees will be hurt by this, that they will be the losers, because one of the things that pretty much everyone agrees on, whether you're pro-union or anti-union, is that unions tend to get workers better wages, better benefits, better working conditions, more protections. So in the absence of, with unions becoming weaker, they will be less able to do that.
So now are states and unions trying to figure out a workaround, or are they just kind of like laying low at the moment? You have about 30 seconds to answer that question.
Some states are going to fiddle around. Some states already have fiddled around with the duty of fair representation. So, for example, New York State has passed a law that says that in grievance and arbitration proceedings, if you're not paying dues to the union, they can ask you to fund the costs of your grievance and arbitration. You might see that more in red states. Unions are not crazy about that. Unions want to have, you know, as many people actually in the union as possible and encourage them to join. So we'll see a little fiddling around the edges, but this decision is going to be hard to displace in its main holding.
We've been talking about the landmark labor decision by the Supreme Court yesterday that effectively guts public sector unions. Joe Slater is the Eugene N. Balk Professor of Law and Values at the University of Toledo College of Law, and he specializes in labor and public sector employment. Joe, thanks for being with us. It's The Morning Show.